Hello and welcome. It's been a week that's seen a new method of technological warfare used against Hezbollah in Lebanon. First pagers, then walkie-talkies simultaneously exploding in people's hands, pockets, bags. Dozens killed, thousands injured. No comment from Israel's spy agency, who's said to have meticulously planned and physically infiltrated the group's supply chain. We'll look at how it happened, why now, and what next.
The enemy has transgressed all laws and red lines. We are going to call this the Tuesday and Wednesday massacres. It's a war crime, a declaration of war. You can call it what you like.
It's been a week that's seen another apparent assassination attempt against Donald Trump. The 58-year-old suspect said to have hid for hours in shrubbery at the seventh hole of the Trump International Golf Course before being spotted by FBI agents on Sunday morning. The former president says he was bundled into a gold buggy as gunfire rang out and seized on the moment to claim it's the inflammatory language used by his rivals which is stoking the violence.
There was yet another assassination attempt on my life. I didn't know I was going to say that. It was the second one in 8 weeks by a violent radical left mobster. But thankfully, our outstanding Secret Service agent, and they are outstanding, spotted the barrel of his rifle in the bushes. Can you believe that?
And it's been a week of, are we nearly there yet? Waiting for the new French government to be announced. A decision is supposedly imminent. And Michel Barnier, the Prime Minister, only 2 weeks into the job, is finding he's a hit with the public. New polls suggesting he is now France's most popular politician. It's his colleagues he's been struggling to convince. News of a clash with President Macron, between Barnier and his predecessor, Gabriel Attal, over apparent plans to raise tax. We'll try to peek behind the curtain and let you know what's really going on.
Nonetheless, it'd be better to have a government. Why is it taking so much time? The president already took 2 months to appoint a prime minister. Now it's 2 weeks more.
Welcome to the world this week. Joining me from the International Press Corps this week, in the studio we have Ana Navarro Pedro, Paris-based journalist for Portuguese media. Hello, Ana.
Hello.
We have Philippe Moreau Chevrolet, hey. The political scientist, backed by popular demand, also the president of MCBG.
I love to be popular.
You are, tonight. Maybe not as popular as Barnier, but
no,
we'll get into that.
No, not as popular as Barnier, nobody can.
And it's a great week for some political manoeuvring to talk about in Paris too. We also have, from Istanbul, we have Barzu Daragachi. Great to see you, Barzu, seasoned journalist and now senior fellow at Atlantic Council Think Tank. Pleasure to have you with us. And let's cross to London too, where we have Patrick Smith, editor of the Africa Report. Patrick, there's never a dull moment when you are on board. Thank you for joining us again.
Greetings. Thank you.
Well, we begin around half three in the afternoon in Lebanon on Tuesday. News starting to emerge of a mass incident involving pagers exploding, thousands of them within an hour of each other, reportedly triggered when the recipients, who are alleged members of Hezbollah militant group, received a message from their leadership. I had to double-check the headline on my mobile as reports came in. It didn't seem real, like something out of a John le Carré, maybe. And these two videos capturing a fragment of what was happening up and down the country. This video here, a detonation as someone shopped at a Beirut fruit store. You hear the bang, he hits the floor holding his midriff. And then the same thing, a customer by a cashier at a different supermarket who's holding it, checking it as it blows up. Hospitals overwhelmed with scores of people being rushed to A&E, similar injuries to their faces and legs. The next day, Wednesday, 5 in the evening, another round of blasts, this time different communication devices. Hundreds of walkie-talkies exploding in the same way. In total, 37 people died, including an 8-year-old girl, an Iranian ambassador to Beirut, among the more than 2,500 injured. Who was behind it? Israeli secret services, Mossad, in all likelihood. No comment from Tel Aviv. How did they do it? Why now? Where is this heading? By Thursday, all eyes on the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah. All limits, rules, red lines had been crossed out, he said.
There's no doubt that we suffered a major blow, both on the security and the humane front, which is unprecedented in the history of the resistance, at least in Lebanon.
Which takes us to Friday and missile attacks from Hezbollah into the north of Israel, and then a statement from the Israeli military after a rare strike in the capital of Lebanon, in Beirut, saying that they had taken out one of the elite commanders of Hezbollah along with 10 militants. Let's begin in Istanbul. Basu, first of all, let me get your reaction when you first saw the reports of the pager explosions.
I mean, it was unprecedented. We're getting used to this kind of cycle of unprecedented escalations in this war between Iran and its allies and Israel and its allies. And it's, you know, it's quite disturbing and quite dangerous. What worries me is, as with introduction of drones into warfare, as with the introduction of electronic and cyber warfare, Iran and Hezbollah and their allies will reverse engineer this capability. And the next thing you know, you'll see whatever, papers, walkie-talkies, mobile phones, smartphones, not in Tel Aviv or Washington.
This is the best
thing
It sounds breaking in and out a little, Basu, but I think we got the drift of what you said. Actually, Philip, Basu's point there that this could be an era of a new technological warfare.
It's certainly new, but it's not unprecedented. We saw targeted attempts, killing attempts or killings by drones in the past, so that's not the first time that technology is used in order to be, you know, trying to be so...
But then there's drones and then there's pocket warfare, pagers,
yes,
communication devices.
But I think we are a step. We are not there yet. I mean, from the other... The technological advantage is on the Israeli side. First of all, this is unprecedented. They did it in plain sight. I mean, they eat their piece of,
the explosive.
Explosive inside phones before they were even delivered to their destination in the factory. So it requires a lot of intelligence, a lot of technology, and I'm not sure that Hezbollah has the means to do it on the short term. But what I like in what Barzou said, and we don't hear that in France, and it's really important, it's a war between Iran and Israel by proxies. Mm. And in France, we don't see that at all. I wanted to say that. We don't see that. And that's very important.
Yeah, it is. When you look at what I think we heard it in the speech from Hassan Nasrallah, yeah. Anna talking about this is probably the biggest blow that they've had in 40 years. And this was, a scenario where, listening to Philip, his point was perhaps the Israelis have the only capability to carry out this now, this type of warfare that they're using. Before we talk about the missile strikes and the assassinations, the idea of using this type of warfare and the ethics and legality of it too.
The idea of using this type of warfare is not new. The Americans in the Vietnam War had ceded the supply lines of ammunition, supply lines to the communist guerrilla with the corrupted ammunition and arms and guns that killed the ones when they were shooting. Syria did the same. Bashar al-Assad did the same, supplying the black market of ammunition with corrupted guns and ammunition that really made lots of carried a lot of damage to, you know, in the Islamist groups. So this is not new. The fact that they are using also some radio frequency to detonate, it's not new as well. Remember all the radio detonated bombs in the 80s and in the 90s. So, but the whole thing, the imagination, the going forward, the brain storm that came to it, and the organization, we are seeing some news. Let's keep it in brackets. Waiting for confirmation, but some news from Lebanon actually saying that they were manufactured in a firm in Hungary, but it only had one employee, this firm, and a very high business, chiffre d'affaires business factor billing. And they said that they had been manufacturing, actually, we don't know where, the beepers for, which are very much used in certain areas for nurses, doctors, and so forth. And probably that's what seeded the idea that this was the place to go to for a purchase by Hezbollah. But still, it's a huge breach of security by Hezbollah and by Iran, going along with the idea of Philip that this is a proxy war between Iran and Israel, or maybe between Iran and even the United States.
Well, it was a Taiwanese company that produced the pages. Now, the Taiwanese company said
Motorola
that,
in the beginning, well, then giving the license to the Taiwanese, then giving
right,
it to
so
the...
Right, so the Taiwanese company have the pages. What they've said is a Hungarian company that bought the right to use the Taiwanese name on their manufacturers. Now, they're saying it appears to be Bulgaria and not Hungary. So that's moving away where that comes from.
Yes.
We also have the walkie-talkies, which appears to be a Japanese firm, out of service years ago.
They investigative are saying that these, journalism still exists,
right,
even
and this
if
is,
it
this
has
is
been
ongoing.
Buried under a ton of whatever.
Of course.
And we'll have the final word of it.
That's the globalization at its best.
And yes.
We can trace the beepers.
But if this is true, it means that they planned ahead very, very long ago to get the trust in order to go for this. Now the question is, why? We've seen Nasrallah, and going along with your idea again, Nasrallah on his speech, he's keeping sitting on his hands. I mean, there are some missiles going into Israel. Israel responded with the bombing of Beirut and killing of one of the Hezbollah commanders. But basically, Hezbollah is sitting on their hands. And why? Maybe because Iran is not ready for a full-scale war in the region until maybe they have nuclear weapons, nuclear bomb ready. Because that will definitely change the configuration of all the region if they do.
Patrick, in London, when you're listening to the conversation about just the methods used, whether this is new or not, certainly pages around in the 80s, it's been the first time there's been a mass infiltration of the pager system. Give me, before we get onto the why, just your interpretation, your reading of Mossad's ability, though denied, it's likely to be nobody else but Mossad, of being able to carry this out.
Well, you think a year ago, Mossad was blamed for the greatest breach of Israeli security, probably since the Israeli state was formed. So I think part of this is, if you add this pager attack together with the killing of Hamas political leader Hania right in the middle of Tehran, you add those two things together, I think Mossad is trying to send a signal that they're back in business. And on the Mossad side, I think it is very much an assertion of their technological power. It's also a particularly personal blow for Nasrallah, because he is the man who told that the other Hezbollah operatives to stop using mobile phones because the Israelis could target them and blow them up. So it was his insistence that they used pagers that then maybe seeded the idea in the Israeli Secret Service that they could start to find a way to kind of infiltrate the supply chain for the pagers. Now, you know, what you were saying about the research that's being done into whether this is a Hungarian outfit or a Bulgarian outfit and how they structured their supply chains. One thing is clear, that Hezbollah had bought a consignment of these pagers without doing serious due diligence on them. And again, so that is a massive breach of Hezbollah's own security processes. And of course, it does disable their own communications ability to respond to what we're now seeing today, the killing of Akil, one of their big operations officers in Beirut. We're seeing the lack of their communications ability to confront further Israeli attacks. So I think on all levels, it's an attempt by Israel to kind of recover the initiative absolutely on this and to give Hezbollah and Iran behind them some pause for thought in the coming weeks.
Let me put to you, Patrick, on the question about legality. This is Sir Geoffrey Nice QC, who represented the prosecution of Slobodan Milosevic at the war crimes trial. He said one of three things. Possibly, he said, if it was distributed in a way without certain knowledge of where these militants might be at a certain time, and they got into the hands of non-combatants, what we saw, reportedly, an eight-year-old girl killed. Secondly, that the attack was on civilians, and it's conceptually pretty much the same as Hamas unguided missiles into non-military parts of Israel. Thirdly, the question of proportionality, about whether there's just a justification. What's your take on the ethics and the legality here?
Well, Jeffrey Nice is a seasoned expert in international law, and I think his points are extremely strong. I mean, it is absolutely and yet another breach in international law. And while you're on the question of international law, this week the UN General Assembly voted, I think, 124 votes to 40 to condemn Israel's occupation of Gaza and invasion of Gaza and occupation of the West Bank. So I think. So I think it's another legal defeat for Israel. But right now, I guess everyone's really focusing on the military situation. But I don't think there's any gainsaying what Jeffrey Nice is saying about the legality of this form of warfare. And I guess the real threat there is that it's kind of it's going to be normalized. And it may be that as we speak, the Iranians and Hezbollah planners are looking at ways they can inflict a similar technological hit on the Israelis, which I think will be a very difficult thing to do, given the level of preparedness in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv.
Well, you talk about what next on the ground. Let's have a listen to Yoav Gallant this week, the defence minister, describing the action as a new phase of war, sending a second division to the north. There is two divisions in Gaza, two divisions dealing with Lebanon now. Let's have a listen to what he said on Thursday.
Over the past several days, we have been holding a series of important discussions. This is a new phase of the war. There are significant opportunities in it, but also significant risks. Hezbollah feels it's being persecuted, and our sequence of military actions will continue.
Bazou, in Istanbul, what's your take on what's happening right now? We heard Anna talk about, why now? And maybe there was an expectation that there could be a follow-up military offensive, which didn't happen. So tell me what you're reading. You've followed this for a long time.
I mean, the why now is almost obvious, to spread fear and intimidation, to make the Hezbollah military planners understand that this war could hit them personally in their own homes and so on, which is, technically, what many would consider kind of a terrorism by definition, to highlight the damage that could be done to civilians in the case of the war. But it's really, I think, meant to hit people in their homes and to make them, understand how close this conflict could get to them. It's not just going to be over there. It's going to be inside your own apartment.
It's worth saying, if, as there are sources close to the Israeli military saying that they haven't ruled out that there could be a ground offensive in the south of Lebanon to push Hezbollah fighters back, to regain and allow residents of northern Israel to go back to their homes and not be facing missile strikes. It's worth saying, Bozu, that for those with a short memory, there are echoes of this happening, 82 to 2000, when Israel did push Hezbollah militants back. And it was Ehud Barak, the prime minister at the time, that actually pulled them out again, and Hezbollah refilled that vacuum.
Well, exactly. That was with the Palestinian militants that were, based all over southern Lebanon. That was an effort. And that was kind of a real, strategically and, geopolitically, it was kind of a defeat for Israel in the end. There was no Hezbollah, at least as a kind of popular political organization and state within a state in Lebanon in 1982. And the Iranians and allies exploited the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon to create Hezbollah, essentially, and make it the voice of the Shia Lebanese, which were not a part of the Israeli calculations when they first invaded.
Philip and Anna, Philip, with you first. The news today in the Wall Street Journal that suggests sources close to Joe Biden that he will not be pushing for a ceasefire, that this last proposal we're expecting to call for a ceasefire, it won't happen now, likely until we see a new president in the White House.
I think he won't take any risk and he won't make any decision of that kind before the election is gone. I mean, it's in 47 days, so it's not the timing to do anything. And if he makes a decision, there will be people that won't be pleased by this decision one way or another. It's better to say, I could make a decision. I want to, maybe, but I won't because I'm respectful of the election process, the democratic process Yeah, we don't know that in France, but you can be respectful of a Republican democratic process. Ooh. And maybe he's doing that, you know, and it's good to see that he's doing that.
But it's worth saying why that matters, because if we look at Hezbollah's raison d'etre, what it says, it's, you know, same with the Houthis, that they are in solidarity with Hamas. And that, ask any analyst, this won't be sorted until there is some kind of ceasefire in Gaza. But it's quite bleak to know that we have a few more months where nothing is likely to happen if these sources are correct.
And so much can happen at the same time, because precisely not knowing what the result of the election may be in the United States and where the degree of willingness to help or not to help Israel is going to stand. This is the most dangerous time, where maybe Netanyahu is really pushing for a war. This is a provocation, what happened in Beirut. Whether there is this line being put forward by Israeli press, according to which actually the maneuver, the plot had been discovered by someone in Hezbollah, and he was about to warn the top command, and it will be gone. So either they explode it then or never. It seems to excuse Israel for what can be said, as our friend said in Istanbul, could be seen as an act of terrorism in the civil population. But the time is going to be extremely dangerous now. The thing is, we didn't see a military operation going immediately after. So that's why so far, because it can come tomorrow, but so far what... by Israel. So far, what we can say, this was a provocation, definitely, and was a provocation probably trying to get Hezbollah and Iran to respond in order to give some excuse for Israel to go in with full strength. It hasn't arrived yet. It hasn't happened yet. Can they hold on for more and more weeks until the election in the United States? We'll see.
Okay, so from one conflict which shows no sign of peace anytime soon and escalating, to another which is often overlooked on a world scale. Tuesday morning, the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, spoke to reporters, and he told them about what he'd seen on a visit to Sudan, a country in the middle of war, little sign of resolution. He said mass displacement, now more than 12 million people, was, quote, shocking, had become the largest displacement crisis in the world. Mr. Tedros made two other points that said shocked him to the core, that the attention in the global community was, quote, really low, and that he believes racism could be a factor, essentially that black lives, especially in Africa, attention is low, does not get the same, he said, as white lives.
The international community has not given this crisis the attention it deserves. WHO is working closely with our partners to do everything we can to meet the huge challenges these communities are facing. But what they need even more than the aid we provide is a ceasefire, a political solution, and peace.
Well, it's been more than... well, almost 18 months, I should say, since the conflict began between two belligerents. You have the Sudanese army, the SAF, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, led by General Mohamed Hamadan Daglo, widely known as Hameti. Now, these men were once allies who joined forces 5 years ago to oust the then-president Omar al-Bashir. Now, they each accuse each other of being a war criminal in a conflict that's lasted almost a year and a half. Close to 20,000 people have died, 12 million displaced, 25 million facing acute hunger. Patrick, let's begin with you. You followed this closely. Where is the conflict right now? Where is the balance of power?
Well, it's really difficult to work out on the ground who has got the advantage. But if you look at all the headline events in the war over the last 6 months, you've got to say that the rapid support forces under Hameti have been more successful in their attacks. The critical point at the moment, and why the head of the World Health Organization was so distraught, was that there is the fight for the capital of North Darfur, El Fasher, raging at the moment, and both sides are throwing everything they possibly can into this, and particularly the RSF, which has been launching missiles into the city of Al-Fasha, and in a hope to weaken the population's resolve there to oppose it and then seize control. And if it did that, then it would be the dominant power in Darfur. And that's a part of the country that's as big as, well, half of Western Europe. It's a massive area. Mm. And if that happens, then you've got something similar to what happened in Libya, only probably much more, even more unstable than Libya. You've got a partition of the country where the West is controlled by the RSF, and the remainder, and just bits of the remainder, are controlled by the SAF, that's the Sudan Armed Forces, under Burhan. So that's how it is. But I think that the real red flag around what's been happening in the past 6 months is the continuing backing of the combatants by external forces. Mm. A lot of attention has been paid to the United Arab Emirates' support of Hameti and the rapid support forces, despite their sort of well-documented human rights abuses. Equally, Egypt and Turkey have been supporting the Sudan Armed Forces. And this has led to an escalation in the fighting, if you like. And neither of those two sets of parties seem to have any interest in negotiating and pressing their proxies into some negotiation for a ceasefire. And the other powers involved, such as the Saudi Arabians and the United States, don't seem to have the political inclination or the muscle to bang their heads together and try and get even a humanitarian ceasefire, let alone a political deal. So it really is a terrible situation that, as you said, is putting the lives of 25 million people at risk from acute hunger. Yeah. It's an absolute national and international disgrace.
So you have aid organisations, and the MSF, one of the very few that be able to get some kind of access, saying it is nowhere near enough. We talk about 25 million people at risk of acute hunger, famine, nowhere else like that right now in the world. You talked about it, Patrick. You have this proxy warfare going on. If you have in the West, the RSF, where it has its traditional base, going back to the Janjaweed militia, and similarly accused of genocide and rape, as it was 20 years ago, supported, the accusation is, by the United Arab Emirates. Essentially, you have countries picking over the carcass of Sudan right now. That's the accusation. You have the UAE with the RSF. You have Iran. Let's talk about them briefly as well, Patrick, because I think they are quite keen, and I'll bring Anna in as well on this, on the Red Sea and having some access and supporting, therefore, the Sudanese army.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, Iran is certainly backing the SAF. The SAF, the main military victories it's achieved in the past few weeks or months have been due to its use of Iranian-supplied drones. And that's interesting because the SAF was trying to court Western support, saying the RSF are beyond the pale. And then they reopen relations with Iran, and Burhan meets the Iranian officials, and as a result, is losing any sort of diplomatic sympathy in the West. So, you know, you've got this sort of balance of bad actors on the ground in Sudan, but also among the sponsors of the war, and no real political will to bring people together and to get some sort of settlement. But the Iranian factor has exacerbated things for certain.
Anna, you wanted to come in.
Yes, I was wondering if Patrick could explain something. When this war started like a year and a half ago between the two generals, who were strong men of the former dictator al-Bashir, of course, when the dictatorship came down and they became the two strong men of the country in this fake democracy, you'd believe that at one point they would start eating each other's noses. But it started last year, and then there was a news, and that's where I would like to ask Patrick if he could tell us about it. There was this news that Russia was going to set up an important naval military base in Sudan, in Port Sudan, I think. Mm-hmm. The trigger for other external powers to support the two generals, one against the other?
I don't think it was just one of the complicating factors.
Okay.
So certainly both Russia and Iran have been trying to get some sort of base on the Red Sea. And Burhan, as his predecessor leaders had promised, we'll look at it, we'll see it, to keep them on the hook. But I don't think that was necessarily the trigger. I think the trigger between the two men was personal greed and aggrandizement. And the trigger on the side of the UAE, it should be said that the UAE has benefited hugely from Hemeti's commercial operations. Mm. That is, smuggling gold from various gold mines he's forcibly taken over in Darfur and smuggling that gold to Dubai. And that has helped fund his warfare and, of course, has added to the largesse in the United Arab Emirates. So I think, there's a strong commercial and a strategic interest on behalf of the United Arab Emirates. Not to mention, of course, Hemeti styles himself as a sort of a chief anti-Islamist. And that goes down very, very well in the UAE with its strictures on political Islam.
And it should be remembered that the point of the Sudan, those two leaders, was to try to help restore some kind of democratic government, to which now, with questions about war crimes allegations, it does seem further away. Now, we talk about the displaced. It is quite hard, very hard, in fact, to get access. We can get access to some of the displacement camps. Here is one. This is one of the displaced amongst many talking to reporters this week about their situation.
We are suffering from a lot of mosquitoes and snakes. As you can see, houses are empty. People have all run away. The situation is miserable. We have no food. Things are expensive in the market, and we don't know how to feed our children.
Basu, when we look at this issue, you know, we go back a few months, we were talking about this as we follow the events on a weekly basis. But when we really discuss it, you know, we often talk about the forgotten war. We hear it again with Dr. Tedros at the WHO, just back from there, talking about how the world is turning a blind eye, coming up with race, he said, as a factor. What do you make of that?
I mean, I don't think it's just race. I think also, you know, Sudan is kind of off the periphery for Western media and so on. As has been noted, regionally, there's a lot of interest on the part of regional governments, and I don't think it's fair. I understand where your other very, very intelligent speaker was coming from, but I don't think it's fair to call them bad actors. You know, I mean, I think these countries, UAE, Turkey, Egypt, Iran, Russia, and so on, they're pursuing their interests in a vacuum that the West and the UN, you know, had a huge part in creating by not supporting the Sudanese people's democratic aspirations enough when they rebelled and overthrew a dictatorship. You know, the Western world and the international community, took a shortcut and cut the generals in on the transition, and it was inevitable, and many predicted that this would happen. And so, you know, it's like the 30 Years' War in Germany, you know, where you had all these regional powers coming in and pursuing their interests and making the situation worse. That's what's happening in Sudan. That's Syria as well.
It's interesting, Philip. Basu, talking about the actors, we're not talking, we haven't mentioned, unusually, the US. We have heard Joe Biden this week calling for both sides to get back to the table for a peaceful solution. This is not just about the US on its own. We talked about on the programme, peace talks here in Paris. President Macron was involved in those. What do you make of the French role in this, the US role as well?
It's not the French debate for the moment. We don't have a Minister for Foreign Affairs yet, so it's the President could actually do something, maybe, but he doesn't have the political strengths that we used to have. We've lost a lot of weight internationally, both in the EU and outside of the EU, so we're not in a situation where we can actually impose on things. He doesn't even try. I mean, we don't have any African policy to speak of. We didn't have that for a long period of time now, not really. We had a strong African policy with Le Drian, Jean-Yves Le Drian, when he was Minister for Defense, maybe a little bit when he was for Foreign Affairs, but for 6 to 7 years, France has been, you know, quite... it's not exactly... We didn't exactly leave Africa, in a way, so much as Africa didn't want us anymore, in a way. We saw a lot of, you know, a huge backlash, partly Russian-oriented, but partly on its own. Africa decided to get rid of the French influence, so we lost a lot of ground. I don't know if we can recover from that on the short term. It doesn't go that... I mean...
Well, does it chime with something...
We don't have strong diplomats anymore. I
mean, no. That's a good point, because something that made echoes and waves here in France was comments by Dominique de Villepin, the former Prime Minister.
The problem is...
France is not there.
The problem is, formerly, we had like 10 strong men. We could handle the French diplomacy. Maybe 5 of them were really the upper ones. But we had a team, many people. Nowadays, they basically changed the rules of the game inside the diplomacy, the French diplomacy. The way it's distributed, the way it works has been drastically changed, and it's been a trauma for the French diplomacy. And we don't have any strong men because the Élysée and the president is doing everything by himself, which is, you know, maybe he's a brilliant guy and everything, but it's not enough because it's only one man. Mm. And Stéphane Séjourné, for instance, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, which will be the soon-to-be...
EU Commissioner,
is only repeating basically what the President says. No offence, he's a bright guy, very nice, but...
So that's not what you want from a foreign minister.
I don't want anything, especially nowadays. I just see that things are going that way. We have lost grounds in Africa in a way that is dramatic. Yeah. I don't know if we can recover that.
Well, which takes us on to whether we have the ship back in motion here in France and whether the government gets back together. Because when the news came 2 weeks ago that the EU's former Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, had been appointed as Prime Minister here in France, some had the joke. Analysts talking about how he was better known in Britain than he was here in France. Well, Monsieur Barnier, his reintroduction to the political scene is proving a massive hit with the public. Look at this. He is currently... the most popular politician, according to polls this week. He's the Taylor Swift of French politics. President Macron, let's take a look where he is. Let's go back to 44th place, just holding up the division. Jean-Luc Mélenchon in 46, only just behind.
Yeah, that's not a good sign. For the record, it's not a good sign. Mélenchon is the most hated guy in political sphere in the country.
So that's not where you want to be.
Politics, yeah?
That's not where you want to be if you're President Macron right now.
No, but Macron has the unique ability to make his prime ministers hugely unpopular because people want to be with the prime minister instead of the president. So we like him immediately. We want him. We want something.
Well, that said, going's going to be tough then for Mr. Barnier. He tried to stitch together a multi-party government based on inconclusive July election results. The centre-right leader seemed to suggest this week tax rises were the prescription needed for France to ease the pain of the economic outlook. By Wednesday, reports of rows with President Macron, a clash with his prime ministerial predecessor, Gabriel Attal.
Le Premier ministre affiche aussi ses...
Mr. Barnier, well, where are we now? It reportedly appears to be that we're going to get in 48 hours a new announcement of a government. Let's begin. Philip, back to you.
Yeah.
What are we going to see? What are the rumours suggesting?
First of all, the date should be on Sunday. I talked with one of the soon-to-be not anymore ministers recently. He told me by Sunday it should be closed, and everyone is telling Sunday. So we should have a government by the weekend, the end of the weekend, if everything goes well.
Now, the big question is how you have a government of many parties within the Republican arm.
One-third, supposedly the mix is one-third the presidential side, one-third the strong right, Les Républicains, and one-third external elements, maybe from the left, at least one guy from the left. Maybe it will be respected, we don't know, but what we see is a strong turn to the right. But mostly this is another Macronian government, it's nothing really has changed. And for the voters, that's something that is unprecedented. I mean, usually when we vote, something changes, and this time, no. And the president, there's something to be said about Emmanuel Macron. I've never seen a politician doing what he's doing, recovering from two major defeats and still be the center of things and still be organizing French politics as if nothing happened.
Yeah.
I've never seen that anywhere else.
Still acting as Jupiter, as some analysts have suggested, is more
but
likely.
He's managing to do it.
Yes.
He
might be the Boeing space aircraft that landed to Earth. But
I'm not in favour of that thing, but no. He's doing it. So it's like...
He's carried it off.
Yeah, it's like Rocky the Fourth. I mean, you expect him to lose.
Ivan Drago.
Right, but he defeats the Soviet
guy. Here's the thing, Anna. Philip, yes. Talking about here, we've got an announcement on Sunday. He's told us what French press as well suggests might be the makeup. One figure on the left, some figures on the centre right, lots of within Macron's party to make up this government. If that's the case, what are the omens for this government?
We don't know. It will all depend on the extreme right wing in parliament, whether they abstain from voting a censorship motion or whether they voted. So it will depend on their dealings with this government, with the prime minister, whether they, you know, when they gave their blessing to his nomination, to Barnier's nomination, they didn't ask for things that were in their program. Like the, for instance, the end, I don't remember the word in English, the end of this law on
reform to pensions.
Exactly. So they asked for a tough line on immigration, for instance, and they asked for proportionnel, how do you say it in English?
The proportional ballot. Representational.
Exactly, in the ballot, which doesn't exist in France. If you have that introduced in the voting system in France, of course, the National Union or National Front, as it used to be called, this extreme right-wing party, they would be absolutely ahead of everybody in this country. So they probably, Barnier has this carrot that he can show to Marine Le Pen's party, saying, well, we can introduce a little bit of a proportional ballot, and if you are nice to us, then Marine Le Pen might have this fool's option of saying, okay, but you have to give it to us in order for us not to bring you down. How long it can last, we don't know.
Bozu, I want to come to you and first want to listen to the left here, because Philip made clear, if this is the case, that we are seeing the French left, the popular front of the left, which won the election, they were 100 seats short of a majority, and yet if they've got only one cabinet member, well, they're not particularly happy. Let's have a listen. Bozu, no, go on, you first, and then we'll have a listen to La France Insoumise. Tell me.
I think what you're talking about is, you know, the typical recipe for disaster that the center-right has engaged in since the 1920s. Instead of, coming up with policies and politics that appease the majority of the people, the center-right goes to the far-right in a crisis and hands them the keys. This happened in the U.S. to some extent and led to the rise of Trump that we're, still dealing with. And it happened in many other countries as well. And, it's a curse to some extent. And it shows why, Macron is unpopular. It's because his policies are unpopular. And he refuses, raise the retirement age, explain why, and give a, equally punishing kind of policy to the elite. Raise taxes on big companies and billionaires that are basically the base of Macron's government and philosophy.
Actually, I'll put to you what the left had said. It said basically that people were out. If you remember, there's two phases of the election. Those people that said they will form part of the Republican arc, within what they call the political centre, and they'll vote left. They won't... Well, they actually blocked the far right. And now they're going to see a government where they're not represented. Very briefly, Bozu, are there reasons to be cheerful here? The popularity of Barnier, the fact that he's got people into position. Has he got legs?
No, there's no. I mean, if they can hold the center, fantastic. That's great in this troubled time. But you have a reality in which French politics, as with other European politics, are moving to the extremes, and no one is addressing that, and they're just trying to play the same game, and it will lead to the rise of the far right.
Great to have you on the programme. Bazu Daragahi, Anna Navarro-Pedro, Philip Moreau-Chevrolet, thank you to you as well. Patrick Smith in London, thank you all. In a week where one catchy song by one man on his keyboard watching the US presidential debate became such a viral hit, he is now on a European tour. The Keefness, a.k.a. David Scott, playing Berlin tonight, coming to Paris next week. So until then, bonsoir et bon appétit.
They're eating the dogs.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
They're eating the cats.
Meow, 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 meow.
They're eating the pets of the people that live there. They're eating the dogs.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
They're eating the cats.
Meow, meow.
This is betel nut. It's a fruit, and it's part of Taiwanese culture. I don't take any myself, but customers say it warms them and wakes them up.
When you chew the strongest ones, you can almost faint.
This small green fruit is nicknamed Taiwanese chewing gum. Although it's legal, it's also highly carcinogenic.
I've stopped. I'm scared of cancer, but they're not.
I don't care. As long as I'm not sick.
In Taiwan, hundreds of thousands of people consume betel nuts. Thousands more make a living of its production.
It doesn't cost much to grow betel nuts in Taiwan. It's very profitable.
We can make a lot of profit because the market is huge. It's why betel is known as green gold.
A profitable market that holds back the government from legislating. Watch Taiwan's betel addiction on France 24 and France24.com.
The history of our world is ever-changing. The flow of information is constantly increasing. We cover all subjects. We verify. We commit. On the ground, in all circumstances, to anticipate the future by understanding the present. We are with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. France 24, understanding the news.
Liberté, égalité, actualité.